tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 5th of March, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that we do have our esteemed guest, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, back here with us today. Just before I introduce him, I also want to let listeners know that CarolynJaeger.net has been revamped. William Fink has been working on that site. Even though Carolyn is retired, the information on that site is all still there. It's all been preserved. We used to feature Carolyn Jaeger here on Radio Albion and on the stream. We used to play her podcasts and her research and her studies into World War One and World War Two are pretty much unparalleled. So if you haven't ever heard of Carolyn Jaeger before, I do recommend you go and check out CarolynJaeger.net, have a look at her podcast and have a look at her work. And that's also somebody who Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson also used to work with. You were just telling me, Matt. Anyway, thank you for coming on the show once again, and thank you for still being here. We were really worried about you. How are you now that the hospital has let you go?
I do appreciate that. I got a lot of letters, a lot of support. And it's not quite like being in prison for 2 years, but I was quite sick. My third hospital visit since October. Same typical stuff, you know, high blood pressure. But I have all that under control. I'm feeling much better than I thought I would. I'm getting stronger every day. But I'm at a point now where I just can't work 24 hours a day like I used to. I was very overworked by my own choice. And, you know, when you work on four books at a time and, you know, you sleep when you feel like it, it catches up to you. And so I'm quite pleased. I was very touched by all the support I have had. And I know I have some very good friends out there. But I'm feeling very good right now. I'm in a good mood. And as much as you're happy to see me again, I hear me again, I'm very happy to hear you. I'm still not quite over the fact that you are out and functional and are unscarred by your experience. I'm more or less unscarred by mine. And I hope this is the last time I have to deal with all this. I never got sick before. I don't know what being sick is. I got COVID a few years ago and then this. That's it. Oh, and I had a kidney stone. That was fun. Otherwise, I don't know anything about being sick. I'm just not used to it. But I was treated extremely well. The hospital I went to a different hospital this time, state of the art out in Pittsburgh. And I'm very pleased with my progress. And I also want to report my buddy and one of my security cats, Marcel, is have late stage cancer, and he's with me right now. So he's not a human being, but he is part of God's creation, and he's been with me for a long time now, 10 and a half years. So, but you know, my wife Jennifer, I have to say, she was with me the entire time. She couldn't sleep, and she was sleeping in a chair. She advocates for me. She knows her medical stuff, and you go to the hospital, remember, someone has to be, you can't go to the hospital by yourself. Someone has to be, they have to know someone's watching. That's, you know, a lot of people who specialize in this kind of thing say that. You have to have someone there. Jen would not leave. And it's taken her quite a bit of time to recover from that because it was so uncomfortable. But she, having someone like that advocating for you is is extraordinary. And I do need to publicly thank her for that. She was just, this is why, you know, you get married. This is why, you know, what young hot girl could do that for a guy? You know, zero. Unfortunately, Jennifer, the Jennifers of the world are very few, as we know. And I took one. So I feel a little guilty about that. I think there's maybe three left in America. So you guys better get going.
Well, you certainly sing back to your old cheerful self. And it reminded me, really, I mean, the last time that you weren't here, I think it might have been that you might have been on a honeymoon with your wife and Russia invaded Ukraine. And we had no expert to talk to about this. And this time you've been away in the hospital and America has invaded Iran. That's what we're going to be talking about today. We have three articles from globalresearch.net. We'll start with the first one. The Israeli-American attack was an attempt to decapitate the Iranian government. The country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, was killed, along with almost his entire family, in a bombing of his residence and office. There were also serious violations of humanitarian law with attacks against a primary school, resulting in the deaths of over 100 children. Unlike previous cases where Israel attacked Iran, this time the Islamic Republic reacted immediately, and not only against Israel. All US allied countries in the Middle East have been and continue to be targeted by Iranian missiles and drones in a relentless bombing campaign. Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Iraq, Jordan, Oman, and even British bases in Cyprus have been targeted by Iran. Tehran is trying to inflict as much damage as possible to all military and energy infrastructure that enables US and Israeli operations. Oil facilities in the Gulf are being destroyed, as well as ships linked to Israel or the West in the Strait of Hormuz, which is currently only partially open, with Iran allowing passage only to ships from certain partner countries. It is clear that the US and Israel were not prepared for such a profound reaction from Iran. American and Israeli authorities seemed to expect a late and moderate reaction, as occurred in the 12-day war. The intensity and frequency of the Iranian attacks have caused a kind of partial strategic paralysis in the US and Israel, as well as in the affected allied countries, which simply could not anticipate the bombings to activate security measures efficiently. Media reports indicate that the US approached Iran through the Italian government to suggest a ceasefire agreement, which was promptly rejected. There seems to be no interest on the part of Iran in de-escalating the conflict in the coming days or weeks. The situation becomes particularly tense, considering that it involves not only military and strategic factors, but also issues of national pride and patriotic sentiments, considering the assassination of the supreme leader and civilians, including children. Now, it's interesting here that he talks about strategic paralysis amongst the partners of America, because what's in the news at the moment here in Britain is that Keir Starmer knew about this 17 days ago, and instead of sending a battleship over there to defend our Cyprus base, he waited. He thought he would look at the legal implications of it. And I guess he was looking at that and thinking, well, Iran won't attack us back because it's illegal for them to do so. Is it legal for America to attack them? And it's like he just seems to have forgotten the fact that we don't live in a world of red tape and legality. We live in a world of dog eat dog. And if somebody attacks you, you attack them back. You don't go looking to see what the regulations say that you should be doing. So Keir Starmer's really been caught with his pants down if he knew about this 17 days ago. It was quite obvious that if anybody attacked Iran, that whoever attacked them and their allies would then be attacked back. But Keir Starmer just, I guess, is like a rabbit caught in the headlights. I mean, this strategic paralysis, this seems to describe him perfectly, I think. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, as you know, as everyone knows, I stand with Iran on this. They're in the right, and they're winning handily right now. What do you know? The American policymakers are so ignorant in these, pretty much everywhere, certainly in Central Asia and in Eastern Europe. They didn't expect a profound reaction. Iran is a first world country. They have first world standards for everything. This is not, you know, Congo. But there is, for them to not expect a massive reaction, that can only come from the fact that they have built in their brains an Iran that doesn't exist, this third world, you know, goat herders, whatever they think. Iran has been preparing for this probably since the early 80s. They're a militarized society, not because they want to be, because they have to be. But it's precisely because Iran is first world that that's what threatens Israel. Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Libya, they were all on the cusp of becoming first world societies, which is why they were targeted. Now, why would the U.S. go through the Italian government for a ceasefire? It means that their bases are being destroyed. It is very – now, I've gone to – and you're right, by the way, as an aside, every time I go away either for, you know, vacation, even when I was young, and hospital now, something major happens. I just take it for granted every single time. But why would the U.S. go looking for a ceasefire? It means that they're losing, and they're running out of supplies. This has been their American supplies are critical right now, thanks to Israel and Ukraine, and don't forget about Taiwan. It was rejected. If the Iranian government didn't reject it, there would be riots against them. Because they want Israel and the U.S., you know, or at least the U.S. military, destroyed. I've been saying for many years, we've been saying for many years that those bases that he mentions here were very vulnerable. The Russians maintains, they have been supplying Iran for some time. So these aren't just any old missiles. These are first class, but they're Iranian made, but they're based on Russian models. And it's, you know, Iran, all of their materiel is buried in the mountains. It's a heavy, it's a massively mountainous country. You can't invade it, really. Iran was never a colony. It's very different circumstance. The U.S. doesn't, they can't wrap their heads around it. Killing the supreme leader, yeah, it was a, they think that that's going to stop this. You know, like this is a tribal chief or something. No, it's a first where you kill a chief executive sort of in any industrialized country. It's not going to destroy the government or destroy the country, but they really think it does. Whatever Donald Trump has done in his presidency, any money Doge saved has all been removed. There's one reason, and you know, I thought that the U.S. destroyed the nuclear plants. I thought that they were the first attack was victorious. Apparently not, as of course we all said at the time. Iran is as far is fairly invulnerable because of the terrain, and the fact that they every day their military trains for this kind of thing with the U.S. in mind. This is not a third world backwater, and I'm going to send you a paper that I did some years ago. I did an Orthodox nationalist on it many years ago, explaining in depth what Iran truly is. And I don't have to tell you guys that, of course, everything you hear from the press about this is a lie. You have to go to other sources, many of them sometimes personal ones that I know, out in Russia and elsewhere. Russia stands with Iran as well, as does China. And the U.S. is already exhausted. This was a stupid move. And it's already backfiring.
Well, we've been saying this for a long time, haven't we? That eventually Syria or Iran or any of these other countries that Israel just takes it into their head to attack is going to fight back. And they're not going to do it in a measured way and say, well, we're just warning you now that we're going to take out or fire some rockets at this base over there tomorrow. They will literally just snap and fight back. And that's exactly what seems to be happening. American authorities, including President Donald Trump himself, publicly stated that the operation had achieved its objective of eliminating the Iranian leadership, and that from that moment on, it would be up to the local Iranian population to fight against state forces and complete a total regime change, thus seeking so-called Iranian freedom. However, the popular reaction was in the opposite direction, with increasing popular support for the Iranian retaliation. This miscalculation on the part of the US and Israel is typical of their military mentality focused on decapitation attacks and quick assaults. The US is accustomed to short-duration wars, rapid invasions causing high destruction to the enemy, and promptly evacuating without significant attrition. Similarly, Israel, being a small country with limited resources, has always maintained a strategy of decapitation attacks, attempting to eliminate the leadership of anti-Zionist countries and armed groups in a fast manner and with minimal military effort. However, this strategy is extremely limited. The US has been successful in operations against small countries in Latin America and some failed states in Africa, but has always suffered when facing prolonged wars of attrition, such as in Vietnam or Afghanistan. Similarly, Israel has not even managed to neutralize Hamas and Hezbollah, which are non-state militias, by carrying out their decapitations in recent years. All this reveals is the clear limitations of this type of strategy. Iran is a country of considerable size with over 90 million inhabitants and a complex political structure consolidated since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Popular support for the state is widespread. Otherwise, the country would have already undergone some kind of regime change, considering that the West constantly promotes mass protests and attempts at color revolutions there. Countries with such structure and complexity cannot be easily destabilized by quick decapitation operations. And that's the first thing that struck me about this, is how absolutely arrogant, incredibly arrogant of Donald Trump to think that if he just bombed the country, the people there would thank him for it, and that they must hate the regime there. Well, I'm sure a certain minority there probably do hate the regime, but I should imagine the majority just like the stability. They don't want the country to be destabilized like this, which is what they're going to end up with. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Iran, again, it's more of an idea as far as American policymakers go. They have projected their biases and constructed this country. How long have I been saying that? But what is Iran? She's the 14th before the war, 14th in the world in the number of daily newspapers, 18th largest economy in the world. Her life expectancy is 74. She has fourth highest budget surplus, account balance. She is a creditor nation. Her gold reserves, I think, are the seventh largest in the world. She has one of the largest scientific establishments in the world, and I believe is either the lowest or second lowest in suicide rates, which I think is very interesting. In terms of scientific articles, scientific breakthroughs, she's seventh in the world, third in university enrollment, on and on and on. This is a successful country. And that's the problem. That's been the problem. The Ayatollah many years ago issued a fatwa that the nuclear war is immoral and we're not going to be building this. I can't tell you the number of times I've had to explain to intelligent people that the sort of plants and chemicals that are necessary for nuclear power do not just transfer over to nuclear weapons. That's a completely different plant, a completely different process, a completely different chemical. But the Iranian government is so far seeing, they're well aware that the oil is not going to last forever. They are extremely diverse. I know that their exports are heavily oil-based, but internally, thanks to Russian and Chinese trade, Indian trade, their GDP is very, very diverse. Their biggest problem over the years has been opium addiction. But that's, I think, something that the U.S. used as a weapon. The fact that they shared a long border with Afghanistan didn't help. Interestingly, Iran's cancer rates are the lowest in the world. I think it's 148 of 194. It's one of the healthiest countries on the planet, and that was reflected in her economic growth. None of this, however, has occurred to anyone in the Pentagon, State Department, and the executive branch. And I've been warning about this. This kind of ignorance, you know, sometimes I laugh at it, I make fun of it, but now it has serious consequences. Israel was flattened back in whenever the first war, the 12-day war was. They're running out of ammunition. They're really – the Iron Dome turned out to be a joke. And now it's gotten worse to the point where they're looking for a ceasefire. The U.S. is not capable of a war of attrition. As he says, and he's right, But the Iranians are, and they're waiting for it. They don't have to do anything. They are so deeply dug in. The American infantry at this point is pretty green. They're getting tons of Russian and Chinese assistance. Iran is in a very good position. Strategically, in terms of her, as I said, her topography, she is almost invulnerable. Her mountains are loaded with metals. Her whole country is one big fortress, thanks to the threats from Israel and the U.S. It is not going well. The U.S. only can fight, as they say, have been saying, you know, even these smaller, I don't know what Latin American country he's talking about here, or Africa. The U.S. pretty much loses every time it tries to do something. The U.S., there's no will to fight. U.S. military I'm working on a book on this topic, actually, is physically falling apart. No one knows. The Pentagon, the budget is huge. Where does this money go? And, of course, American morale has always been very low. And Israel's learning the hard way. They've gone too far. And I think the Iranian government, for whatever problems they may have had in the past, there's a rally around the flag. It is extremely popular now. The population, being very literate, knows who to blame. There's no protest against this. The only protest against the Iranian government would be if they didn't respond harshly enough. Yeah, they want regime change, all right, but in Washington, not in Tehran.
Well, it seems as if America just unquestioningly relies upon Israeli intelligence, and as if the Israelis don't actually have a dog in this fight or an axe to grind, or might benefit from, sort of getting America to go in there on false pretenses. I mean, we had who was it, Marco Rubio, the other day, and he said the reason why America has gone in there is because Israel said we are going to attack them. And the response to that attack would then be Iran attacking U.S. bases. So America had to go in there with a preemptive strike because they knew that Israel was going to go in there and attack them. And they've admitted this. So they're pretty much admitting that they're puppets of America. Well, many in the United States could scarcely identify the difference between Iran and Iraq, both countries based on ancient civilizations so chronologically distant as to be fiction. If not Marvel, it's not marvelous. But another fiction came into play towards the end of February as the United States and Israel reprised their role as world rogues and crockery breakers by attacking Iran for a second time in less than a year in a joint campaign called Operation Lion's Roar and Epic Fury. Following the vulgar playbook on regime change used against Iraq in 2003 by the US-led forces, a variation of the same theme is being used again in Iran. The difference here is that neither the US nor Israel are willing to commit ground forces. They will kill key leaders and figures across the Iranian regime, leaving an inchoate resistance against the clerics to seize the day. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has apparently been killed, with US President Donald J. Trump calling him one of the most evil people in history. Israel also claims that the opening strikes killed 7 senior defense and intelligence officials, including Khamenei's top security advisor, Ali Shamkhani, Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps commander, Mohammed Pakpour, defense minister, Aziz Nasserzadeh, and the chief of Iranian military intelligence, Salah Asadi. The February 28th statement from Trump was posted on Truth Social in a brief video, declaring that the objective of the attack was to defend the American people by eliminating imminent threats from the Iranian regime. This was curious, given the previous US-Israeli attacks in June 2025 that had apparently obliterated the regime's nuclear program at Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. In this haze of confusion, Trump had concluded that Tehran had, after all, decided to rebuild their nuclear program and to continue developing long-range missiles that can now threaten our very good friends and allies in Europe, our troops stationed overseas, and could soon reach the American homeland. Their missile industry would be razed, the Navy annihilated, the proxies crippled. Members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard would receive total immunity if they laid down their weapons, or you will face certain death. As for the unspecified, great, proud people of Iran, They should stay sheltered as the bombing continued, and when done, the government will be yours to take. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's statement also confirmed the objective of ending the threat of the Ayatollah regime in Iran. That regime had domestically repressed its citizens, instilled fear in the peoples of the region, created a global terror network, invested enormous resources to develop atomic bombs and tens of thousands of missiles intended, as it defined it, to erase Israel from the map of the world. They armed terrorist proxies. There will no doubt be some cheer within Iran at these strikes, notably from the young who have suffered at the hands of a clerical authoritarian regime. Washington's allies will snivel with coerced approval, citing the brutality of Iran's regime, while ignoring breaches of international law that they are condoning. Australia's response was particularly despicable. The Shi'i-Sunni division will be tested, with various US bases and military assets already struck in the Gulf states by a regime trying to survive. The United Nations will continue being treated like a bedridden dowager whose influence was from another day, conduct more contemptible even than 2003, when many Western states did, at the very least, show solidarity in rejecting the use of force by the United States and its allies in the absence of a Security Council resolution. In the meantime, American diplomats who open their frontier-stretched mouths claiming interest for peace and negotiations should make everyone reach for the gun. And that's a point that I made the other day in a podcast. This was all the while peace negotiations were supposed to be going on. This seems to be a tactic of America, is to have peace negotiations, and while the peace negotiations are going on, to assassinate the person that is supposed to, you're supposed to be negotiating with. And another part here as well, I have heard on the mainstream media, they keep referring to the Ayatollah as the most evil man that ever lived and this evil dictator regime, and yet they don't really come up with anything that he did that makes him so evil. They keep saying, oh, he killed his own people. Well, if you look at what Iran had to say about that, they said that they were jihadis that the West had sent in. That's who they were killing. And as evidence for that, they showed you the numbers of the police that had been shot and killed and the damage that had been actually done. I'd like to see how America would respond if there were armed people firing at the police and setting fire to government buildings. I'd like to see, you know, whether America could get away with that without any shooting of the so-called protesters. Matt, what are your thoughts on this? You must have seen some of the mainstream media as well as the alternative media. You must have heard them referring to the Ayatollah as the most evil man who ever lived. I mean, I always thought that was Adolf Hitler.
Well, you know, in Israeli literature, they're always comparing the two. He's largely a caricature. Ever since 1979, he's a sort of government figure. He's almost like a monarch, as most of us know. Journalists don't know this. The government is very different from the idea of a head of state versus head of government. I want to point out that Iran is a multi-party democracy. In the major parties, you have like the Modern Thinkers Party, Party of Engineers, the Combatant Clergy Association, Islamic Coalition Party, very pro-revolutionary. And you have a centrist party like Moderation and Development Party. You have to be Islamic, of course, just like in America, you have to be liberal. But the Iranian government, because of its performance and the performance of the economy, and the state has quite an interest in it, American politicians would kill to be this popular. And frankly, you know, this is the same thing for Putin, Lukashenko, all these other people, and they're the American, you know, everyone in America, no one trusts the government, no one trusts anybody in any kind of power. Interestingly, the only institution in America that scores high is the military, not realizing that the military is a part of the same government that they dislike. And this proves, though, everything that we're talking about here proves what I've been arguing for a very long time. This is kind of boring for me at this point. I got out of the hospital and I start reading this stuff. You know, haven't I been here before? It's all the same stuff. Although I do like the phrase, the United States and Israel reprise their role as world rogues and crockery breakers. I may steal that one. Keep in mind that the U.S. is notorious for lying about its casualties. I have a paper on this, and it is very, very creative how they cover over killed in action. Whatever number you hear, it's multiplied by at least five. Now, I'm not sure about the defense officials. Israel has been assassinating nuclear scientists over there, which is simply murder. But the Iranian military is prepared for this. All of this is nothing new and not unexpected from the Israeli military. The Iranian military, which is very large and extremely well trained. The U.S. has no chance if they were to actually physically go in. I remember when I was a freshman in college, and Desert Shield took place. The U.S. is simply not capable of that today. They don't have the men, they don't have the money, they don't have the supplies, they don't have the merchant marine, and they also don't have the support of Turkey. And that's extremely important. Turkey is vehemently opposed to all of this. And you may have read Spain has refused to allow the U.S. to use any bases, which means that NATO itself is in serious trouble. I always said 2016, foreign policy is going to be Donald Trump's big weakness. But that's kind of the main focus of the presidency. That's the one thing that they can do. Not committing ground forces? Well, there's good reason for that. Donald Trump can't, and the Pentagon, I think, would be opposed to it. They're going to lose. Remember what happened in Iraq. First of all, the U.S. almost lost. A lot of that, you know, I had to go to other sources to find out how that was. Britain lost a huge chunk of its air force in Desert Storm. You can't believe anything the press says. Donald Trump, unfortunately, his popularity has gone down. He was elected on a domestic concern, domestic issues, but also on the fact that he wouldn't do this. All of his information, as you said, many others, comes from Netanyahu, who himself is in serious trouble at home. I also like the phrase, in this haze of confusion, because the ignorance, absolute ignorance in the foreign policy establishment in Washington and the think tanks around it, it is a haze of confusion. This is pure Johnson's law. The press could pretty much say anything. And I guess, well, where else are you going to go? Well, I know where to go. The missile industry has not been raised. Proxies have not been crippled. If anything, they're getting recruits from all over the world now. And this all started with the Hamas invasion of Israel. And it was something that was the goal of Hamas, get the rest of the world involved in this. The Israelis were defeated by Hezbollah in 2000. Their invasion of Lebanon was stopped. They've lost against Hamas right next door. What are they going to do against a first world military focused exclusively on facing Israel in the U.S. with strong support from Russia and China? China by far the largest economy in the world. Netanyahu, of course, is always over the top, Likud stuff. And keep in mind, though, who had won the presidential election, they'd be doing the exact same thing. So foreign policy, it doesn't really matter. It's not really Trump's doing. It's anyone would have been doing this here. I also take exception to the young who suffered at the hands of the clerical authoritarian regime. I think any opposition internally comes from those who are educated in the West. That's my opinion. A lot of young people support. I really want a stricter form of Shia Islam. Shia is very different, I think. Over the years, I've come to the Alexander Dugin, too. It's far more philosophical and far more reasonable, despite some of their severities, than Sunni Islam. And the Kurds, of course, who everyone hates, were sent in as cannon fodder. I think that's another thing. Killing his own people, I think they're referring to Kurds there. That's not going to go well. Because they're just not capable of going up against the Iraq war. You had Saddam Hussein had to divide his forces on the Turkish border and on the Iranian border. So the U.S. barely defeated a relatively small fraction of Saddam's forces. And even now, up in the air, you're dealing with a peer adversary. Most naval aviation can't fly. There's a huge pilot shortage. There's a shortage of spare parts. Aircraft carrier shows up, maybe a third of those planes can get up in the air. And they have very little combat experience. And destroying these bases, you're going to hear nothing but lies about them. I told you they were vulnerable. You said they were vulnerable. There's no missile defense. They're using some hypersonics they got from China and Russia. And they're winning. They're winning, if it hasn't happened already. I keep going back to their desire for peace talks. Why would the U.S. go and seek a ceasefire if they're winning? Now, gas prices have gone up in the U.S. It has nothing to do with this war. The U.S. gets no oil from the Middle East. And even if it did, the effect on prices wouldn't be immediate. It would take a while, which is proof that there is no market in oil. And the oil industry is looking for any excuse to raise prices. Oh, my God, there's a war over there. Oh, well, you know, prices go up. There was a war there. What do you want? And in fact, it's just the gouging. It should not be affecting American prices whatsoever. Just show you the corruption of that industry. And that's something some mainstream writers have been saying. The regime is not only surviving, but it's going to thrive. And I think you said it right. Not international law is a joke. It's the rule of the strongest. The only use for international law is rhetoric. When someone says this war is illegal, I laugh. Illegal? What, are the policemen going to come and enforce it? It's all just, you know, whoever has the upper hand. When everyone talks about legality in international relations, like they're talking about downtown Detroit, anyone who talks like that really should be avoided. Who gives a damn whether there's a Security Council resolution or not? And of course, the Russians and Chinese would veto it anyway. So it doesn't, you know, it means absolutely nothing anyway. But the author here is someone I know, and he's better than this. But still, his points he makes are very, very good.
Well, you brought up Turkey there. I saw a little video last night. I think it was Benny Gantz, who's sort of quite high up in Netanyahu's government. And he said Turkey is where they're going next. That's the country that they're next going for after Iran. Well, let's have a look here at a quote from President Trump. He said, "The Iranian regime, a vicious group of very hard, terrible people, its menacing activities directly endanger the United States, our troops, our bases overseas, and our allies throughout the world." President Trump's statement is a composite of ignorance and lies. Iran has never been a threat to the United States, nor to US allies around the world. Nuclear negotiations ended with a deadlock in Geneva on Friday, 27th of February. Iran has made several concessions, but did not agree with the Trump administration's demand for zero enrichment for civilian purposes and to dismantle all related infrastructure. And I'll just interject there. I mean, their civilian purposes, they needed it for medical purposes, for radiation treatments. And I should imagine the other civilian purposes might have been needing nuclear reactors to replace the oil. So, I mean, there are genuine reasons for a country to want to be enriching uranium. Trump claimed the stalemate negotiations as a reason for finally getting to grips with Iran's nuclear threat. The deadlock of the Geneva indirect nuclear negotiations between the US and Iran is understandable. Most certainly, such a coordinated Netanyahu-Trump attack on Iran's strategic sites cannot be carried out overnight without months of prior preparation. In fact, preparations were scheduled to continue this coming week in Vienna, Austria, where the UN-regulated International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, is headquartered. Thus, it just shows how fake such US-led negotiations are. Not for the first time, they are planned as a deception to disguise an attack on the negotiating partner. How do Americans react to the Zionist-US tandem assault on Iran? According to a March 1st, 2026 Reuters poll, only 1 in 4 US Americans support the Trump-Netanyahu aggression, meaning that Trump's popularity is taking another deep dive. The assault was, of course, carried out in full coordination with Israel. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz announced that the country had carried out a preemptive strike on Iran to remove threats against the state of Israel. President Trump later confirmed US participation in the attack, vowing to dismantle the Iranian nuclear program, raise the Iranian missile industry, annihilate their navy. With the Zionists having martyred Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei and many members of his family, the Trump-Netanyahu couple from hell may feel the first step towards regime change is made, even if it does not immediately achieve its goal. Lots of intermediate benefits may accrue for the aggressors. Petrol prices may rise, increasing oil companies' profits. The potentially temporary oil and gas shortages may negatively impact the economies of China and Europe. And the US and Israel may control a huge chunk more of Middle Eastern energy resources, let alone the $1 million worth of hydrocarbons offshore of Gaza. And you wanted me to take a pause there, Matt. I think you wanted to make a comment about some of the things that he was saying here about the petrol and gas industry.
Well, the author here is usually very, very good. And this is, I'm surprised he would say something like this. A lot of people are just very rushing to get something out. I mentioned where the price rises are coming from in the West. U.S. gets zero oil from that area. It's a fairly small percentage that go through the Straits of Hormuz. I'm not sure where this energy shortage may come from. China has so many diverse sources. Well, it gets most of theirs from Russia anyway. There's a glut of oil on the market, so I don't know where he's getting that from. And I'm not sure how they're controlling more Middle Eastern energy resources. If anything, it's the opposite. And then, of course, now he's right to bring up the Gaza stuff, you know, and keep it again. This has happened right after a genocide in Gaza carried out by Israel and with U.S. support. No one is supporting the U.S. here. One in four, I have the feeling, is a bit overestimated. I think it's much lower than that. But from domestic support for Trump, I guarantee you the only real base of support is evangelical Christians. Orthodoxy certainly doesn't, and much of Catholicism doesn't. But I want to point something else out. You interjected, you talked about Turkey. Thinking that anyone could take on Turkey and win at this point is delusional. You know, the size, it's like it's no different than Iran. Keep in mind, Iran and Turkey have been allies for a long time. Turk and Persian against Arabs, long standing. And I think that's going to get stronger, especially since now the Kurds are involved. God knows how many of them have been killed by now. And the fact that the U.S. are using them against Iran means that Turkey is all, you know, very upset by this. They've made an enemy. I would be shocked. I mean, let me put it this way. NATO is in serious trouble. Turkey is the largest force in NATO. The U.S. is larger on paper. Turkey, even, you know, beyond their numbers that they report, they have a very large military establishment that the U.S. depends on for their operations in the Middle East. Now, the U.S. is going to have to go to Saudi Arabia or something like that. Its bases there have been very damaged. I would love to see Israel take action against Turkey. Turkey has been very good. They've not been pro-Israel. They've not been anti-Israel. As far as Tel Aviv is concerned, Turkey's been neutral this whole time. NATO member, what are they going to do? That's over. After Gaza, Turkey has cut trade with Israel, cut recognition of Israel, and now going after a longstanding ally, both economically and politically, it's going to get worse. I think there have been protests in Turkey to just cut all ties with the U.S. and NATO. And whenever the response – Erdogan's party loses elections when they don't come out strongly against the Israelis. It took military action, that party would be absolutely dominant. And he knows that, but he's got to be careful. Again, Turkey, first world, first class military, using both American and Russian equipment. And of course, they have their own state owned military industrial complex, as does Iran. And even Russia was using Iranian drones during the war. Yeah, they're unlicensed from Russia, but still, they're made in Iran. These are first world countries. The U.S. cannot handle Somalia, and Israel has been so badly damaged in the last war, and now they're getting smashed again. The West doesn't have the supplies, doesn't have the manpower, doesn't have the political will. The Republicans could be annihilated in the upcoming midterms. Donald Trump has, whatever good he's done, as I've said before, whatever good he's done domestically has been totally wiped out. Lots of American boys have been killed. We could talk about casualties some other time, but suffice it to say that when a family gets death benefits, they have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. The U.S. has already suffered high casualties, and very few people know that except in the East. And this has been a ridiculous, stupid gambit, proving, as you said, that, well, Donald Trump may be getting good advice from probably the Pentagon. He dismisses it immediately, and he goes to the Israelis. And this nuclear thing is a red herring. It has nothing to do with anything. There's no nuclear weapons, even if there were. Well, now they really should have it. You know, back in 1964, Mao Zedong, in the middle of his mass slaughter of Chinese, exploded his first nuclear weapon. And I don't recall, I wasn't alive then, but I don't recall reading anything that there was this outrage. Never any sanctions on Peking or Soviet Union, really. So this whole thing is an absolute red herring. And, we started off with a quote, the whole vicious, terrible people. You know, he doesn't really know that much. American troops shouldn't be over there. Iran is in the right. I think rational people stand with the Iranians and hence with the Russians and the Chinese. This is a victory of the axis of resistance. And the U.S. Going through backdoor channels to try to get a ceasefire suggests that the U.S. is in some trouble. And it's making Israel even less popular in the U.S. Getting my PhD in political philosophy, political science, history, and this has been one hell of a ride. I never thought I'd live to see the day that both the U.S. liberalism, we talk about liberalism, the U.S. and Israel would be up against the wall like this, and you could openly criticize them. There's reason to be very optimistic about the world right now.
Well, this sort of thing has to happen, really, to make people aware of just how captured America has become by Jewish interests. I mean, the other day in Congress, there was a guy from the American military in there shouting, "Nobody wants to die for Israel." I mean, this is right at the center of government. When the American battleships were heading to the Straits of Hormuz, the sailors were stuffing socks down the toilets because they knew that this was just for Israel. It's an Israeli operation. Continuing with the quotes here, "What if the attack succeeds somehow, getting rid of the current Iranian government, though not being able to replace it with a Western-friendly leadership? A scenario of a chaotic Libya 2.0 could emerge." I will say that's very likely to emerge. "This might risk sectarian and ethnic violence, resulting in disruption of supply chains and a slowdown of global economies, including the US. Would such a scenario be of any benefit to the United States? Unlikely. Just look at Libya and Afghanistan, which have dangerously deteriorated in the second decade of the 21st century. The aggression on Iran looks like a classic case of prioritizing short-term tactical and domestic political gains at the expense of long-term strategic stability, a situation that could inflict lasting damage on the Western civilization. Alternatively, the Middle East could slide into a regional war on a scale not previously witnessed, with unpredictable outcomes and the potential for a massive ecological, humanitarian, and economic crisis. The repercussions may be way beyond the Persian Gulf states. This is why desperation, not strategy, is driving the US Zionist strikes in Iran. In addition to Tel Aviv and Haifa, Tehran's rockets hit primarily Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, Kuwait, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, all Arab states. You may argue that they are all dotted with US military bases, yes, but they were also among the first ones to commit funding for Trump's Board of Peace, supposedly to rebuild Gaza, according to the Trump Netanyahu's criminal plan to destroy and rebuild while annihilating the Gaza population. The Board of Peace was proposed by Trump in September 2025, and we have covered this at Radio Albion, and formally established on the sidelines of the 56th World Economic Forum conference in Davos in January 2026. To become a member, Trump, the self-nominated permanent chairman of the Board of Peace, requires an arbitrary membership fee of $1 billion. Of the 62 countries invited, as of January 2025, 25 nodded yes to participate, and so far they include from the Middle East, Bahrain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates. The United Nations approved the Board of Peace through Security Council Resolution 2803 on November 17, 2025. In other words, these Arab countries agree tacitly or directly with the Zionist US destruction and elimination of their Palestinian brothers. Iran has always supported and defended Gaza and Palestine as a whole. Thus, membership in Trump's Board of Peace is equal to being an enemy of Palestine, and targeting these Arab Board of Peace members with missiles would appear to be a logical reaction. And that's the first time I've heard this link being put there between the American bases that are being attacked and also by all the members of Trump's Board of Peace. Any comments you want to make on that, Matt?
Well, they go together. The same Arabs that may join something like this are quite dependent on American subsidies and have been hosting military bases for a long time. Pretty amazing how, with this alleged Iranian threat nearby, that they have done very little. They're extremely vulnerable, and nothing has been done about it. The numbers have, you know, they're never going to report it, but the numbers of dead have been very high. Now, countries joining the BOP, they're not necessarily joining it. Some of the Arabs are, but they're not joining it necessarily because they love killing people in Gaza. They have agendas. If this really will replace the UN, you know, people who joined the UN back in the 40s and 50s, that had nothing to do with supporting the agenda. But if this is going to be a new kind of governance, they need to be in on it. They can't be isolated from it. But in the East, you know, they're creating their own institutions, the Belt and Road and Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But being a member of it may have benefits no matter what your political point of view is. Where this goes, this Board of Peace goes, is, you know, this is fairly new. This is a very new, almost unprecedented event. This is more than a non-governmental organization. And it made me smile when I heard that it was first proposed at Davos, and proving that Donald Trump has given up his attack on the system. I don't agree with a lot of what Pete is. I quote Pete all the time on here, and this reads, this is very unlike him. There is no chance of the Iranian government being overthrown. There's a chance of the American government being overthrown and the Israeli government being overthrown. But the last, the most stable government of all here is probably the Iranian. You know, sometimes he has, I mean, you know, Pete is finally talking about, Zionism. He didn't years ago. Now he is. He's right to say so. He's spoken about these bases at all over the Arab world. Iran has no problem going after them. Remember, these Arab governments, the monarchies, unfortunately, I'm a monarchist, as you know, but not really like this. There's a huge number of non-citizens. Percentage of citizens in these countries really are like from 4% to 20%, and they get all the benefits of the oil. The majority of the population are non-citizens, and they do all the work. They're looking for any excuse. This was a big fear, if you remember, in the first Gulf War. Saudi Arabia kicked out all the Palestinians because they were already upset. So people forget that Iran is not counting on it, but realizes that there's this huge number of non-citizens in these countries that are third-class citizens. They're serfs. Actually, they're not citizens at all. because only a citizen can take advantage of the oil. This is something that Gaddafi condemned all the time. The Iranians condemn all the time. It's not discussed. United Arab Emirates is now really an extension of Israel. I think that's 8% are actual citizens. Everyone else is a serf. The citizens don't have to do any work. They get everything for free. They speak English. They're usually educated in the West. People who take care of everything in society are non-citizens, and you could do whatever you want to them. Iran has always been very populist in that regard. We talked about the border peace already. A lot of these countries are just hedging their bets, though, like Turkey or, you know, even Belarus. They're hedging their bets. They don't know. Yeah, they know that Donald Trump is creative. It's interesting. I don't mind the U.S. takes a hit here. The U.N. takes a hit here. I don't care. Remember that when Israel invaded Lebanon, their main target, it was to terrorize the population, but also their main target was the U.N. They killed U.N. people all over the place. I think they attacked all of the U.N. Bases in the southern part of the country. I think 10, 15 official were killed, a couple of soldiers from Indonesia, stuff like that. Who cares about them, right? According to the media, that's okay. And so Israel just, you know, they're at war with the UN. Fact of this is that Davos really, you know, upsets all of Trump's supporters. They know what Davos is. And it makes me happy that, yes, Americans are ignorant, but they know enough to oppose this kind of thing. Edmund Burke used to say, the populations are smart enough to know that something is wrong, but not knowledgeable enough to know what it is. And I hold to that here. American bases are smoldering. Israel is smoldering again. And the winners here are Iran and Turkey. And I think this is a time for Turkey to leave NATO. Spain has already, you know, essentially done it. France has a history of doing it. Europe is very split. Even the elites are split on this. And it's something we've been talking about and predicting on this show for some time. And as I said, it's backfired. Putting boots on the ground, out of the question. I think they would be completely destroyed almost immediately. And especially given the fact that they're being commanded by people who know very little about what they're doing, what Iran is. I don't want to see American boys killed. It's always going to be. Always men, always boys. And I don't want to see that. They shouldn't be there. None of them should be there. And this is what you get when you have an empire but have no money or support to have one.
Well, Iranian authorities prepared for this aggression. Apparently, Tehran arranged for deliveries of long-range air defense systems, missiles, and fighter jets from China and Russia. They also set up a system to rapidly replace top military commanders in case they are eliminated. But is Iran's military capacity sufficient for an on-scale counter-offensive? Maybe that is what Pete Hegseth referred to when he said Operation Epic Fury may be a long-lasting one. Moscow condemned the Trump-Netanyahu operation. The Russian Foreign Ministry described it as a premeditated and unprovoked act of aggression aimed at toppling a government they deem undesirable because it has refused to yield to the dictates of force and hegemonic pressure. On a more philosophical note, and specifically referring to Trump's campaign promises as a peace president, President Vladimir Putin had the following comment. I have already spoken to three US presidents. When a person is elected, they may have some ideas. And then people with briefcases arrive wearing dark glasses and dark suits. These people start explaining how things are done, and instantly everything changes. The permanent imperial state and the corporate and foreign lobbyists that pull their strings are the ones who make the major political decisions, no matter who the president is or which party is in power. The United States is ruled by a corporate oligarchy that seeks to profit and enrich themselves through a permanent war economy based on debt, slavery, resource plunder, and arms contracts. And it finishes by saying, Putin, the master of the understatement. Matt, what are your final remarks for today?
There was no question. I had to include that. I added that, master of the understatement. Putin is a diplomat. For him to talk like this is, it's like taking a shot at, you know, he said things like this now and again, But putting it in such a, you know, I have my book called Russian Populist, The Political Thought of Vladimir Putin. It's a unique book. It goes back only 2012, but it goes into the mentality of Putin as a strategist, as a statesman. He's one of the few statesmen in the world. And he is essentially laying out the corruption of not just the U.S., but Britain, NATO countries, and liberal democracy in general. I've said for 20 years now, Putin is stronger than and more popular than corporate Russia. On the other hand, the U.S. is controlled by corporate America and the banks. The banks in Russia are state-owned, or at least the central bank is. And, of course, we know the situation in the U.S. For Putin to talk like this, he's had it. He's had it with the U.S., and he is all in for Iran. The only country who militarily is in danger here is the U.S., and the U.S., it cannot handle the Iranians, especially when they have fewer and fewer allies, especially Turkey. And Iran is getting more and more popular. Iran being essentially taking on the West by themselves as of right now, although they are very powerful allies, is making them the hero of the developing world all over the place, all in Asia and Africa. They're the heroes here all over the world, except in, you know, Washington and New York. And that Russia and China are so close to the action here makes them central to the resistance. Your state-owned military producers are sending the best equipment on the planet, battle-tested, to the Iranians who've already been trained on it for many years. What do you think Iranian authorities have been prepared for this aggression? What do you think they've been doing for the last 25 years? You know, what do you think? They didn't think this was going to happen? Of course they knew it was going to. They've been dug in for so long. They can't be dislodged. And the U.S. is in you know, doesn't even understand the political system. This is just going to get worse, but it's going to get worse for the U.S.
Well, you have to say that Iran certainly has courage to be taking on the might of the American empire. And, of course, we will keep following these events as they unfold. Thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.